Hello, I'm Ross Carriage, and welcome to How This Is Building Me, a podcast focused on the highs and lows, ups and downs, of all those involved with cancer, cancer medicine, and cancer science. And I am particularly happy to have as my guest Dr. Doug Nye. Doug, would you care to introduce yourself in any way you see fit?
Yeah, thanks, Ross. First of all, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here with you, and always nice to have an opportunity to talk with you on a less formal level. So I'm Doug Nye. I've been here at the University of Colorado for about 15 years now. I'm a neuro-oncologist by training, and my practice here really focuses on patients with primary and secondary brain tumors, neurological complications of cancer, and other things in the realm of neurology that sort of might fit in the cancer center population. So
neuro-oncologists are special creatures. They're double trained in neurology and oncology. Is that right?
Most of us end up getting trained in neurology, and then we'll do additional training in neuro-oncology. There are some very special folks out there who are trained in medical oncology first, and then do some training in neuro-oncology after that. But most of us are primarily neurology trained.
Is there a pecking order? Do the neurologists first look down on the people who are oncologists first?
I don't think that's a great question. I don't think so. I don't think there's any looking down. Still, even though it's a growing field, we're still kind of on the smaller side of the community, numbers wise. So we'll take all the help we can get.
Let's start a little bit about how you, Doug Nye, sort of became a neuro-oncologist. So where did you grow up?
Yeah, I grew up in the Pittsburgh area, actually. So sort of southwestern Pennsylvania, and sort of slowly moved up north. I went to a small liberal arts college called Allegheny College in Meadville, Pennsylvania, and then medical school at University of Rochester. I ended up doing my neurology residency at the University of Vermont, and then back down to New York City at Memorial Sloan Kettering for my neuro-oncology training. And then actually after that, ended up out here at the University of Colorado.
This is your first and only faculty appointment?
This is my first and only faculty appointment. Yeah, I'm sort of surprised by that myself when I realize how much time has gone by.
It's true. It's like, you know, you blink your eyes and sort of 20 years has passed.
That's exactly right.
Are there physicians in the family? Why medical school?
Yeah, so no physicians in the family. I am the first physician in the family. And why medical school is sort of interesting. I wanted to be a physician ever since I was a young kid who didn't really know any better. But I sort of had this fantastical, you know, idea that I would be a country, you know, doctor doing sort of family practice stuff, trading services for eggs or whatever. I didn't really know what doctors, you know, really did or what the possibilities are. And so I just sort of knew that's what I wanted to do. And things sort of moved in that direction naturally.
I think we all go through that. Because, I mean, yeah, I didn't have any physicians in my family either. And so our experience with physicians is either our own GP, yeah, or watching Little House on the Prairie.
Exactly. You know, that's exactly right.
What was he, Doc Baker or something like that?
I think that's right.
Okay, so you go to medical school and neurology. I mean, you've gone from country GP fantasy, yeah, trading services for eggs, to like super, super academic, you know, let's just say intellectual specialty of neurology.
I wish I had really great, interesting answers to these questions. I think what drew me to neurology was that it was, you know, no pun intended, it was very cerebral, right? There was a lot of thinking involved. There was a lot of science and physiology and things that we still don't know a lot about. And also the patients were really, really special. These were people who were highly affected by seemingly simple things, right? A small little blood clot causing a stroke in the brain or neurodegenerative diseases, which, you know, all turn out to be not so simple, but they're a highly appreciative group of patients and people who really need the care and understanding. And so I really really enjoyed getting to work with that patient population. I really enjoyed sort of the subject matter. And I also honestly had no sort of mentorship. I had no one to help me kind of figure out what, you know, what am I supposed to do? What does one do in this situation? How do you pick a specialty? So as with most things in life, I was very lucky. The universe sort of just worked out the way it was meant to work out. But I can't say that there was a ton of, you know, pre-planned, premeditated thought behind, you know, why I was going to end up doing what I end up doing.
I can't remember if I told you this anecdote, but, you know, neurology is, yes, the classic sort of chin stroking, you know, deep thinking kind of specialty. And for a period of time, so I trained in neurology in a place in the UK, and they had two competing hospitals, and then they would have a combined neurology grand round once a week. And they would present a case, and then the other hospital would have to deduce where the lesion was. You know, it was definitely, you got the symptoms, and it was all about neuroanatomy, and then, you know, the scan would reveal where it was at the end. And I can't remember if I told you this, but we used to cheat because my best friend was the junior doctor in the other hospital, and we would phone each other the night before. And then we were just fake going, I think it could possibly in the, you know, whatever. And I don't think they ever caught on.
I love that. That's the perfect system.
So where I was going with this is neurology in some ways is this kind of, you know, really old-fashioned specialty where you're deducing what's going on inside the black box of your skull or your spinal cord, and then sort of MRIs come along, and it's like, well, you don't need your diagnostic skills. You just need to order a scan. So, you know, did that make, you know, the neurological Sherlock Holmes is sort of slightly redundant?
Yes and no. I mean, you know, an MRI scan is only so good, right? It's only so good as the test. And MRI scans are really, really good. But, you know, we get into situations where the MRI doesn't necessarily match the clinical picture, right? So there are still instances where the MRI doesn't explain everything. And those are actually the really fun situations where you know something else is going on. You maybe only have a test that is so good and isn't going to show you the whole picture. But those are some of the fun things to try and figure out, because you think that the MRI should totally replace that clinical deduction, but it doesn't. And so it's good that you're still, you know, thinking about it and not trying to sort of replace the entire clinical thinking with just a test.
Well, the other thing, and, you know, this must have kind of evolved as you spent time in the specialty, is that the tools you had to intervene were classically rather limited. So it was a very unique individual who wanted to go in there, do these esoteric diagnoses, and then go, yep, but there's nothing we can do about it. Yeah, so yeah. That presumably, as that's changed, must be relatively rewarding as you go from purely a diagnostic specialty to a therapeutic specialty.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I truly, this would be an interesting thing to kind of poll the older neurologists about, but I think there always was this deep down understanding that we just haven't tapped the power of therapeutics yet. I think everyone in neurology sort of know, even though we're sort of getting, everyone's making fun of us, you know, there's nothing you can do.
It's only because you're so smart, you see, it's like we're intimidated.
I think we all knew that stuff was coming. We just haven't quite caught up to the brain yet. You know, everything else was following suit, the heart and the lungs and all this stuff. But we had to pull that up from behind. And I think we're seeing that now. I think we knew there was going to come a time when this was, you know, stuff was possible. But you just had to be a believer.
Yeah, you had to keep the faith. I mean, honestly, oncology was the same. It's like, when I started, it was like, why would you go into oncology? It's like, it's all doom and gloom. And now it's, you know, fun and giggles. Well, ish.
Ish.
Yeah. Okay, so you go into neurology. Well, that was in Vermont where you were doing the neurology?
Yeah, University of Vermont.
Okay. And then the kind of slightly sideways move to say, within neurology, I'm going to be a neuro-oncologist. How did that arise?
The best way to put it is another way of just sort of listening to the universe. Neuro-oncology, it was sort of a burgeoning specialty in the sense that it was just really sort of coming to its own, you know, when I started training. And There were no neuro-oncologists where I did, well, again, my either my medical school training or my residency training. And so I had very limited exposure to actually taking care of patients with brain tumors. I would occasionally see one in the ER and you'd say, well, you know, I think something's going on. Let's get the MRI. It looks like a brain tumor. And then you pawn them off to neurosurgery and you never see them again. So I didn't really have any exposure to the field, but I knew two things. I knew as a neurology resident, you do 1 year of internal medicine and then 3 years of neurology. And I was so drawn to oncology as a medicine intern that I actually switched a bunch of rotations with my fellow interns who had no desire to do oncology just to stay on that service. And at University of Vermont, anyway, it was pretty rough because all the oncology patients, they really weren't there just to get chemo. They all were like 1 foot in the ICU. I'm sure you kind of probably had similar situations when you were training. And so it was a lot of work, and it was at times very scary for a new doctor. But I just really loved it. I love the patients. I love the field. And as I was training in neurology, I kept coming back to how much I really enjoyed working with that patient population, and I liked that field. And I started having, you know, this taste of seeing, well, you know, can you come see this patient with a brain tumor who had a seizure and we've got to change their seizure meds, and being this consultant to saying, hey, I might be able to do this. I might be able to actually be the one who could take care of these patients. And so it was a big leap, kind of choosing that as a field and, you know, going down to Sloan Kettering and doing the fellowship. I really had zero idea that this was going to work out the way I thought it would, but it seemed like a great idea. And I took that leap and, I, you know, sort of once again, everything worked out.
You know, it's funny. I think so many decisions are kind of like, it just feels right. Yeah. And then you hope the universe plays along.
Yeah. 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 I think that's right. And I think, you know, there's some magic that can happen there if you just sort of let the universe play out the way it's probably supposed to, instead of fighting it or sort of replanning everything.
How long was the fellowship in neuro-oncology?
It was 2 years.
Okay. And you're going from, you know, quite honestly, relatively small towns to New York.
Yeah.
Was that of a bit of a shock to the system? How did you fit into the New York scene?
I sort of pride myself in being pretty adaptable. And I, again, going back to the, I was never really looking for one sort of situation over another. So whether it was a big city or a small city or whatever, I felt like I could take it as it comes. And I also like new things, sort of that get bored very quickly. And so it was a fun change. It was, you know, moving down to New York City and being a fellow and being in the heart of Manhattan was a great change. I had a blast doing my fellowship work there. It ended up feeling right? It ended up feeling like this is where I'm supposed to be. This is what I'm supposed to be doing.
So one of the things, and we talked about this before, so the neuro-oncologist, I mean, I get it when you're talking about a primary brain tumor, so a cancer that starts in the brain.
Yeah.
But you also kind of dip your toe into cancers which have started somewhere else and then spread to the brain. So a secondary brain metastases. And, you know, you and I have tussled a wee bit as to, you know, where's the turf war? And, you know, when I poke fun at you, it's kind of like, well, the specialization shouldn't just be an anatomic location. Otherwise, we'll have like a liver oncologist because the cancer has spread to your liver. So how much of your day-to-day practice across different tumor types is metastatic, and how does that sit with you?
Yeah, I mean, as you know, and probably everyone listening knows, metastatic disease is much more common than primary brain tumors, much, much more common. It just turns out that we're really busy with primary brain tumors. 95% of my practice is really primary brain tumors and not secondary you know, metastatic disease, even though, you know, statistically, epidemiologically, it should be the other way around. I think that the biology of origin is truly probably the most important thing, much more than being anatomic, although, you know, our understanding of metastatic disease, I think, has rapidly changed in terms of you know, progressive genetic changes that may not be the same biology as a systemic disease. But I look at it as, A, my colleagues are so competent that they don't really need me to tell them how to treat these things. But also, you know, I think that it doesn't all have to be about primary treatment, right? There are areas where I think we can be helpful that maybe aren't always as apparent. I've seen patients with metastatic disease where really what I'm doing is I'm managing rehab stuff, right? I'm noticing, hey, how long has it been that you've had difficulty walking, or why are you in a wheelchair today? Or, you know, and how can we fix that? You know, how can we come from the other side symptomatically and make you stronger? Can we get you to rehab? You know, are you having effects from brain edema, managing of seizure meds? So I think, you know, I think there are a lot of really good ways that metastatic disease can be managed in a multidisciplinary fashion. That doesn't necessarily mean that I always have to be the one that is directly managing the cancer, but, you know, helping with the supportive care.
I think that's a great point. It prompts two questions in my head. So the first is, you know, we're great at prescribing expensive drugs and costing thousands and thousands of dollars, yet the supportive care that you just talked about, which is incredibly important, I suspect is highly variable in terms of access to it. And, you know, do you have tricks up your sleeve as to how do you make sure people get covered for that?
Oh, that's a great question. Because it can be difficult, and sometimes it's figuring out what the justification is. I mean, same thing as prescribing the meds, right? Like, sometimes you have to be creative in how you describe and explain and talk about what those supportive care measures are. You know, when trying to overcome things like insurance coverage and availability, and it can require a lot of time. It can require a lot of work on the part of trying to communicate with providers of those services and, you know, figuring out how to, you know, for lack of a better word, what, you know, sort of game the system a little bit.
Yeah.
But it's gaming the system for what's best for the patient, right? It's not, you're not trying to get anybody something that they don't need. But I think what you realize really quickly is everyone's situation is different. And so just being creative and being flexible about how you try to go about getting them those services. But it is true. It's we're in a far from perfect healthcare system, and a lot of people can't get what they need.
It's weird because I trained in Britain where, you know, much less resource, but they, you know, it was the kind of birthplace of palliative care. And maybe there's a kind of like, well, we don't have the money, but we can make sure we look after people. And when I came here, it was like, okay, so you can have your super expensive scan and your super expensive drug. But the basics weren't even there. When I first arrived in Colorado 18 years ago, there was no palliative care team. The tide that floats all boats is definitely floating some boats more than others.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, not to get totally off track, but we all know, you know, we have a very highly capitalistic society here in the United States, and it's about where is the money coming from, right? What is driving these things? And, you know, it's unfortunate to say, but a lot of times patient benefit is great, but that's not it, right? That's not what's driving the system. The system is what can make the most money or what can save the most money. It's not always directly about what is best for our patients.
I told you there was a second question. So the second question relates to when I've sat in national or international meetings with other neuro-oncologists, they're a little different from you in the sense that they love giving drugs intrathecally into the fluid around the brain through a kind of spinal tap.
Yeah.
And when I challenge them, I go, okay, and so what's the evidence this works? And it's like, well, that's what we do. We did once do a randomized study in, you know, breast cancer or lymphoma, but we just sort of extend it to, you know, what can you give into the spinal fluid must equal the ones you should give into the spinal fluid. Others were trashing the people who aren't in the room, but you know, what do you think? What do you think? Go on. I don't want you to alienate all your friends, but you know, what's your take on intrathecal chemotherapy for metastatic disease?
Someone's going to hear this, and I'm going to get barred from.
You're going to get hate mail.
No, email. I'm with you, Ross. I'm not a fan. Again, it's sort of this idea that a one size fits all. And, you know, you think about it, intrathecal chemotherapy, what we've been giving it for 30, 40 years, and it hasn't changed, right? But our understanding of the cancers has. So, you know, we're throwing something at it that is just because we can do something. And I wish I could say I have lots of examples where intrathecal chemotherapy worked well. And, you know, the exception is maybe hematological malignancies, but from solid tumors, it's just not there. And it's just fraught with so many problems and so many issues for the patient. You know, there's got to be a better way. There's got to be a better understanding of the biology of the tumors that we can find something. You know, this whole idea of bypassing the blood-brain barrier isn't quite as important. And I think, our chemotherapies, our targeted therapies, our immunotherapies are now, you know, much, much better at, say, broaching the blood-brain barrier and affecting those parts of the brain and the cancers that need to be affected. That it's not that the blood-brain barrier isn't important anymore, but it's just not as important as it was. I think we don't have to find any reason we can to just say, forget about it. We're just going to put stuff right in.
Well, the other thing, and I think the reason I was kind of looped into this meeting with the neuro-oncologists is it's in desperate need to empower and organize these very smart people into actually proving or disproving that what they do works. So, because at the moment, there's a lot of, like, I do it because there was that one patient a few years ago and I think they did well. It's sort of anecdote level support.
Yep. Yeah. I think that's exactly right. And I think, you know, the field of neuro-oncology is fraught with this, right? Because our tumors are rare. And so I think there's a lot of anecdotal, well, I did this once and it worked, because there's not, you know, there's not great randomized trials for these things. It's really hard to get, you know, a phase 3 randomized placebo-controlled trial in neuro-oncology because, you know, they're rare. It would take forever. It would be super expensive. So we're doing a lot of that. And I think we get stuck in that, I saw it once, it worked, so let's see, you know, it's going to work again, sort of super thinking.
Yeah, I mean, I do feel that there is an increasing appetite to kind of up the game in neuro-oncology, and I totally welcome that. And, you know, as a collaboration between sort of tumor type specific oncologists and, you know, those who work on sort of metastatic neuro-oncology. The other thing with neuro-oncology is the use of brain radiation, and in particular things like whole brain radiation. And I've seen, at least in thoracic oncology, this evolution over maybe the last 10 or 15 years, where the number of deposits that were acceptable for very focused individual treatment, so-called stereotactic radiosurgery, versus, you know, if there's more than X, you've got to go to whole brain radiotherapy. Some of the holdouts were the neuro-oncologists who were more pushing for the, you know, whole brain radiotherapy. Okay, so again, I'm just going to throw rocks here. So I wonder if that's this perception that many of your patients do so badly, you're still in the, look, you just got to deal with the elephant in the room, which is the cancer, and you got to treat it anyway and not think about, you know, longer term survivorship issues. But, you know, maybe I'm doing you a disservice.
The other side to that is that I think we see some of the unintended consequences of, you know, greater extent of things like SRS, right? We see we've started to see a lot more like radiation necrosis, brain edema, things like that. And we see how affected patients could be. Now, I'm in your camp. I am against whole brain radiation in almost every situation, But, you know, I have seen patients who have had 20 to 30 metastatic deposits with SRS. And is it better? I don't know. You know, maybe, but they also have their own problems that they're dealing with right now, right? Because they are getting radiation necrosis and they are getting, you know, getting steroid dependent. And maybe they're living longer because of it, but maybe they're also living worse because of it. I don't know. I mean, the sort of data on this is there's not great sort of long-term data, but I think again, from the anecdotal perspective is, you know, we see these patients and they are impaired, and what is better for them? Would it have been better to give whole brain radiation than SRS to 20 to 30, you know, metastatic deposits? I don't know. I don't think we know, but I do think that there is a core group who sort of understand that with increasing technology, such as SRS, right, to multiple brain lesions, that with that can come its own set of long-term problems. You know, it's not a panacea. It's not, you know, great, we've gotten rid of whole brain radiation by being able to do these other techniques. But, you know, when you think about what the patients are going through and how they're living, it is getting complicated in a different way.
Yeah, it's interesting because the stereotactic radiosurgery produces this radiation necrosis. And just to explain that, that's not the cancer getting bigger, but sort of the normal cells around it have sort of suddenly decided to die sort of 3 months later, produce an inflammatory reaction. I sometimes use the analogy of like tying your shoelaces together and you're totally fine until you get up to walk, which maybe if it's 3 months later, you know, that's when you fall over. Versus the whole brain radiotherapy, and what you worry is that just sort of trashes the whole brain and the vasculature in the brain, and you sort of accelerate some kind of dementia. Sure. I do think as we understand these things better, we could intervene. I mean, I learned from you the value of Avastin, bevacizumab, for radiation necrosis. And, you know, my head is going like, well, if the median time to radiation necrosis is X, can we do a study where we throw in Avastin at that time period to put it off? You know, would it lower the rate of radiation necrosis if we didn't wait for somebody to have symptoms? But for the whole brain, the issue for me is the relatively short time it takes to manifest radiation dementia, which is probably worse if you're closer to the edge and older. And that didn't used to matter because the longevity of our patients, particularly in lung cancer, wasn't long enough to do it. But now people are living for years and sometimes decades, and it's really only a short number of years before I see it manifesting. But I have my own experience. Is there a very variable range?
There's definitely a variable range, but it also, you know, we forget, and the great example of this is primary CNS lymphoma, right? Like where, you know, you're giving, you know, presumably prior to the radiation, you're giving other medications that also break down the blood-brain barrier like whole brain radiation does, for instance, high-dose methotrexate, right? And there's this high incidence of relatively quick dementia that develops when you sort of double hit like that, right? So I also think we forget about the fact that a lot of these patients have already received a lot of different therapies, right, that may have had their own effects on the brain, and now you're adding the whole brain radiation on top of it. So it is variable when those kind of cognitive deficits develop, but they usually do, and some of them very quickly.
Let me pivot a wee bit to something a little bit more personal. You know, you and I have talked about this before, but for those listening, it's pretty well controlled today, but you do have some vocal tics, which sure, Hopefully the microphone is recording. And would you be okay with just like sharing your own neurological diagnosis?
Sure. So I have Tourette's syndrome, which, you know, is a basically motor and vocal tics that develop pretty early in life. one of those things, there's really, you know, no cure for it, no real known etiology for why it develops.
It just happens. Is it spontaneous, or is there a genetic element?
There may be a genetic element, but it's not like directly, you know, inherited in any Mendelian fashion, right? But it just really kind of spontaneously develops, usually in childhood.
Again, this is an audio recording, so can you describe your own symptoms just on a day-to-day basis? I mean, I realize this is the new normal for you, so it's a bit like,
sure.
What did you have for breakfast? Like, why is that special?
Yeah,
you know, give us a go.
So the tics are generally unprompted, right? They just sort of happen spontaneously. They're a combination of vocal type of tics, as well as various motor things, whether it's an arm jerk or a hand jerk or a shoulder jerk or a head twist, or, you know, it can be, I'd venture to say everyone with Tourette's has completely different, you know, manifestations of what they experience. But, you know, they just happen, you know, from day to day, you know, during the day. There's usually some sort of very brief sort of buildup, meaning like, you know, they're going to happen. They're in that way, they're sort of semi-volitional, but they sort of have to happen. And then there's this sort of relief when they do happen.
So I think you told me you can sort of consciously control it, but not for very long.
Not for very long, yeah. And that's typically a hallmark of it for most people, is that, you know, you can suppress them. They are volitionally suppressible, but not for long periods of time.
And just to, you know, put a bow on that, we're talking seconds, minutes, hours. How long can you suppress them?
Seconds to a minute, maybe.
Okay. Do things make it worse? I mean, I think you're very chill and relaxed today, and it's noticeably better.
Yeah.
I think when I've, you know, surprised you and sort of said, hey, here's a really difficult case, you know, I think it's more, or maybe it's just because you're in the clinic when I kind of, you know, yeah, burst in. Yeah. So does stress alter it?
Yeah, so definitely stress, definitely, you know, fatigue, things like that, you know, very similar to any other neurological type of disorder. When, you know, there's a million things going on, when you're really stressed, when you're really tired, those things do tend to make it worse.
How old were you when they sort of first made the diagnosis? You know, when did you get labels stuck on you?
You know, probably started most noticeably around the age of like 10 or 12, but I probably didn't get a diagnosis until about like 16 or so.
Is puberty a trigger?
Yeah, so puberty can make it worse. They can be subtle in childhood, but I also think that like motor tics and things in childhood are relatively common that are not necessarily Tourette's. But oftentimes puberty will kind of cause a flare in the symptoms.
The hallmark of Tourette's is this sort of version that they always put in the movies, which is some guy kind of swearing and, you know, yeah, throwing things and just being, you know, the weird guy. But you have never called me any particularly rude words to my knowledge. So is that just one extreme that only occurs in the movies?
That's the movie version, right? That's the funny version that everyone wants to laugh at. That is actually extremely rare, that type of manifestation. So it's not the common kind of presentation for it.
Do you take any medication to suppress it, if I can ask?
Sure. Yeah, I do, although most of the medications don't really work all that well, to be honest. But I do take medication. I don't know that I've stopped the medication to see if like it was still working or not. I just sort of take it and you know, hope for good days. But yeah, there's not a lot of great therapies out there for it.
Does it limit things that you can do? I mean, you know, presumably you're less likely to have some fine motor skill where you're, you know, crafting an ice castle because, you know, one tick can make it fall down. But like you said, you're adaptable. So how has this influenced what you do on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, it really mostly has not. I can still do things that everyone else, that, you know, I can still do lumbar punctures. I can still, you know, do minor procedure. I'm not trained for major procedures, nor do I want to be doing
that. Like, this is your neurosurgeon, Dr. Null. It's like, no, I want another one.
You know, but I can still, we won't still do that. You know, these things are sort of suppressible for that amount of time that you know, I can do to those things safely. So, you know, aside from maybe starring in movies,
I'm still waiting for that call myself.
I'm not waiting by the phone for that. But it really hasn't impacted what I can do.
So one of the things when we've talked before is how your peers or, you know, your supposed mentors address this as you were going through, you know, education and medical school and everything else. And you have such a great personality. And, you know, I think people see that and they see, you know, how much you care and your kindness. And for me, that just completely sort of, you know, dwarfs any first impressions of, you know, the guy whose arm moves and is, you know, and he has these funny vocal tics. But presumably not everybody does that. Presumably there are first impressions which are less favorable. And sure. Can you share some of the stories?
The baseline thing I think I would try and communicate is, like, you know, patients are coming to you because they've got an issue. And we need everyone out there practicing medicine, but patients aren't coming to us because of allergies or they've got a runny nose or they've got pink eye, right? They're coming to us with serious problems. And, you know, not that those other things aren't serious problems, but these are life-changing diagnoses. And, you know, I think setting the stage that, of course, like, we're here to help them. Like, that's my job, despite anything you're seeing or hearing or, you know, experiencing from our interaction. My job is to figure out how to help you. And I think if you set that stage early, most patients are not, in the end, particularly bothered by it. The people who have been bothered by it more so are our colleagues and, you know, I don't know what we're calling, you know, professors in medical school and things like that. And really sorting this, having this conversation about how I remember, you know, you have to be really contrite about this and you have to apologize to patients and you have to make sure, you know, they know exactly what's going on. And that was all for their benefit. I'd realized after the fact, right? That was for, you know, the medical school's benefit and, you know, sort of, I think, crossing their T's and dotting their I's. In the end, most patients didn't care. And if they cared, they asked and we had a conversation and that was it. I've really found that most patients have not been, you know, it has not impaired our ability to form a therapeutic relationship because they're there for them and I'm there for them. And that's, you know, that's kind of our job.
Yeah. I mean, my impression, I think you told me that, you know, there, you know, the nursing staff doesn't kind of quote unquote warn the patients about, you know, what Dr. Nye would be like when he walks in the room. It's just you take you as you are. But I do think that visible vulnerability, for want of a better word, probably speeds up the forming of a relationship. It's like, hey, you know, you've got your issues, let's talk about my issues, and, you know, we're in this together. And I personally think it's actually a real gift for a neuro-oncologist to manifest something that just brings you closer to the patient. But you did tell me one story which stuck with me of, you know, I don't remember where you were in your medical training, but I think some, you know, one of the quote-unquote professors, you know, do you remember the quote I'm talking about?
Yeah. I believe it was a... it was a primary care doctor whose office I was in and basically told me that I should just stand in the corner and be as quiet as I can so that I don't disturb what's going on, you know, in that patient experience. And,
it's,
you know,
it's just kind of heartbreaking when you hear that, you know, it's like we could do so much better.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, you do what you're told and you move on and you take it for what it is. But, you know, there's a lot of education that still needs to be done within the profession, right? It's not just the patient.
Yeah. It's funny. Some of the people I've interviewed on this show have been oncologists who've had their own diagnosis of cancer, and you know, when do they you know, arrive in the room front and center, you know, and when does it just become an act of intimacy when you reveal it later in the relationship? And probably the second one works best, because otherwise it's kind of like, you think you've got problems, let me tell you about mine.
right. And I think, you know, that's also one thing I've never wanted to do, is to say, hey, let's talk about me first. You know, first thing is we get in the room, right? And how I try and frame it is that everybody has something, whether it's internal, whether it's external, whether it's mental health, everybody is living with something. And we all can start from that sort of common place.
Yeah. Tell me where you met your wife, and yeah, what does Dr. Nye do in his spare time?
Yeah.
If you have spare time, yeah.
Right. So my wife, I met her in Vermont when I was a resident. She actually was a nurse practitioner. And she was the stroke nurse practitioner. She really started the stroke program up there and got them certified. And so we met in that aspect. And then, I moved away to New York, and we sort of did the long distance relationship thing for a couple years. And when I took the position out here, I have to credit her. We weren't even engaged. I said, hey, do you want to move to Colorado? You know, she had no real reason to say yes, but she did.
Well, it's kind of like a pseudo proposal, right?
It's just sort of pseudo, like, you know, you're not going to, I suppose, you know, move out there together if there wasn't some promise in that relationship. But yeah, so we moved out here together, and then shortly after we moved here, we got married, and you know, our spare time is minimal. She doesn't work in a clinical setting anymore. She's actually, she directs the risk management office at the University of Colorado for the School of Medicine. So she works a lot. I work a lot in our spare time. We have two doodles, a golden doodle and a burden doodle. And so we like to spend time with them and kind of get out and see parts of Colorado and go to the mountains and kind of the normal stuff.
And then I always have to bring this one up, because it's my favorite fact about you, is your obsession with, you know, Peanuts and Snoopy.
Yes. Yes. So really like Charles Schulz, to be sure. But it actually, kind of a funny story, or funny to me. We were in, long time ago. So we were in Las Vegas, and there was an art gallery there, and they had these really big paintings by an artist called Tom Eberhardt. And it turns out Tom Eberhardt was a very close friend of Charles Schulz, and is the only person who got the actual licensing to recreate Charles Schulz's characters. And he sort of paints them in a very kind of pop art sort of way. And so I think we were very sleep deprived and tired, and we bought this painting, and now we have like nine of them. Like, we're obsessed with them. They're hanging all over our house. So yeah, we've become aficionados in that respect.
You could be an art gallery now.
Yeah, well, yeah, I've sort of run out of wall space. So
that's good. Doug, this has been fantastic. My closing thought, I usually end with, over the next 5 years, you know, what does Doug Nye want to be doing, both professionally and personally?
That's a great question, and I'm going to refer back to some of my earlier answers, in that I found that the most success that I've had, if it's success at all, I don't know, well, has just been to be open and sort of let the universe take the path for me. But I'm supposed to have. I've always been really terrible at crafting like 5-year career plans. What are you supposed to be doing in 1 year and 5 years? because I'm just really open. I want to be a good neuro-oncologist. I want to be a great resource for my patients. I want to do what I can to further the field. I'm passionate about education, and I want to, see to what contributions I can make there. But, besides that, it's not that I don't have this great vision for what I'm doing in the future, but I think I'm just really open to not putting myself in a corner, and if an opportunity comes along, I'll take it.
I love it. So, Doug, thank you so much for sharing your life, your philosophy with us. Personally, I think you're the best neuro-oncologist I've ever worked with. You also happen to be almost the only neuro-oncologist I've ever worked with, but I love working with you. So thank you so much.
Well, I love working with you, and thanks, Ross, for having me. I really appreciate all that you do.
You've been listening to How This Is Building Me with me, Ross Kamage. Rate us and review us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, or follow us at Dr. Kamage on X for additional commentary.